Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. This week we're reviewing DC Universe's The Flash, Chris Hemsworth's action franchise Extraction 2, Take That Jukebox musical Greatest Days, and Indie Pretty Red Dress. But before we get onto that, what have you been watching this week, Matt?
Something I've been watching, which I loved the first season of, is Prehistoric Planet 2, and I haven't watched it all yet. I've been sort of portioning it out and sort of watching it with my son as well, so I've got to watch it when he's around. But I just absolutely love this. Like, if you haven't seen it, it's basically like a modern version of like Walking with Dinosaurs, like a David Attenborough type nature program, but with dinosaurs. And it's on Apple TV Plus. The animation on it is just like absolutely incredible, like the sort of digital visual effects. And I don't know if it's just because they're not interacting with humans, you know, it's presented in this documentary style, but the visual effects are just incredible. And I say this as like someone who's quite often like a CG snob, and
more of which later.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, compared to like the last Jurassic film, it just looks so much better, I think. And obviously love David Attenborough's soothing tones any day of the week. And It's just really interesting as well, because they're just, I don't know how, you know, obviously take everything with a bit of a pinch of salt, but they're bringing up all these new theories of what the dinosaurs might have been like. And then I just love the look of it, because they really make it look like a documentary, and they use like night vision, slow-mo, and just kind of shoot it, you know, present it in that way as if they are capturing real animals. So it really does feel like, you know, another, just a real life David Attenborough nature program you might watch. But just with dinosaurs, like, I think my son may even probably thinks it is actual footage, you know, and I don't want to sort of disabuse him of that notion just yet.
Mm. And also, that if you can see. Today we went and saw something very special, didn't we? We saw a sneaky peek of some footage of the new Disney animation film, Wish.
Yes.
What did you think of that?
Yeah, it looks really, really interesting, actually. Jennifer Lee, who's Disney's chief creative officer, and she co-directed Frozen, and she's also written the screenplay for this film. She was there to present and sort of talk about it. And it was great to hear her. She was sort of, you know, very, very passionate, very charming, very engaging. What's kind of special about all this? Two things, really, I suppose, that are special about this film. One is that it's coming in Disney's, like, Disney 100 year, where, like, you know, the studio's 100. So they're doing all these kind of heritage celebrations. And this animated film is kind of embodying that in terms of sort of references and homages and love for the canon. And then it's also got this really unique animated style as well, where in a year where we've also got Spider-Verse and we've got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film coming up that's got sort of hand-drawn effect, and Puss in Boots: The Last Wish had a sort of painterly effect, this has this sort of watercolor effect where they've been sort of inspired by the old production concept art for some of the, you know, the old Disney classics, going as far back literally as Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and then brought it to a sort of CG animated film. So yeah, it just has this really, really sort of interesting look. So a lot of the stuff we saw was unfinished today, so really intrigued to see how the actual finished film looks, because we got kind of flashes of it, and it does kind of look unlike anything you've seen, really. And it even does look different to those other things like Spider-Verse and the Turtles film that I mentioned. But they've all got this kind of hand-drawn quality. That's definitely something that's in the air at the moment in these animation studios.
Bit of a trend, isn't it, in animation? Mm. I kind of like it, but I think it looks better as a still. I think it looks beautiful when you see those images that they've created for Wish. I'm not 100% convinced yet that it works in a film, but we haven't seen the whole film. All we've seen is a little taste of it, and they're still working on it, and they are planning to release in November, on November 22nd. So plenty of time yet for them to finish that. Yeah, it was interesting, and to see Chris Pine is in this playing this king magician, and apparently sings a couple of songs, which is quite exciting. Who doesn't love Chris Pine? And I think I'll enjoy him singing. And obviously Ariana DeBose, trilling away as the lead. You know, she's got a beautiful voice, as we've seen. So
we heard glimpses of them, but they've obviously got huge hopes for the songs in this film, which are written by Jennifer Michaels. And obviously Jennifer Lee's involvement makes you think of Frozen, and obviously the success of those songs. So fingers crossed it will be a big hit there.
A good time at the cinema. Speaking of that, shall we see if there's a good time at the cinema with everything that's out this week? Shall we get started then? On your marks, get set, go.
So you're saying you could travel back in time?
But Bruce, I can fix things. I can save people. I can save my mom. I can save your parents.
You can also destroy everything.
Love you, Mom.
I love you, too.
So how was it this week? How's school?
School was good. Oh, shit.
This is mad trippy. Dude, this is catastrophic.
Matt, this is The Flash. We've literally just seen this as we were recording. We went to the cinema and we got our popcorn in. We had seen it previously, but it was unfinished. So we saw the final finished version. Tell us a little bit about where we find The Flash.
I mean, really, it's picking up from Zack Snyder's films where Ezra Miller played Barry Allen, The Flash, you know, the Justice League movies that he appeared in. We've had a couple of different versions of those. And obviously the DC universe is in a slightly strange state of flux at the moment where Zack Snyder's obviously long been out. You know, it's not really kind of his vision anymore. And we've got James Gunn and Peter Safran taking over as the new sort of Kevin Feige equivalents at DC to kind of create a more cohesive world. But then we're in this slightly strange point. So at the moment this year where we've got several films coming out. I mean, technically, they sort of exist as part of the James Gunn and Peter Safran new DCU, but they're sort of remnants of the old world. So it's a bit confusing, really, as to what's actually going to happen, what's going to become of these characters, you know, whether any of them, whether some of them will play a part in the new DCU, whether none of them will. But anyway, this really, you're following on from the Zack Snyder films, but I would say you don't really need to come to this with a particular sort of knowledge of the character, or I don't think you'll be particularly harmed if you haven't seen those films. And what you need to know is, obviously, you've probably heard of Barry Allen the Flash. He's super fast, that's his main power, and his main problem in life is his dad is in prison for, you know, seemingly murdering his mum, and he's looking for a way to try and sort of clear his dad's name. And this whole film hinges on, through his speed, he's able to travel back through time. And like a sort of, you know, cheeky butterfly, he kind of tinkers with things. And then it sort of makes a big mess, messes up timelines, etc. And so it is a multiverse story. It's a messing with timeline story. And as, again, I'd be really surprised if you don't know this, but it features Michael Keaton returns as Batman, because, you know, we crossed into that sort of timeline where he's Batman. We've got Sasha Calle as Supergirl in a timeline. It's a real sort of multiverse film, that very much, again, a trend of the moment. Yeah, that's it really. Yeah, Flash multiverse movie. So it's, you know, it is the Flash's solo film, but there's lots of other characters of interest in there as well. And it feels like a big DC movie, really, rather than just a Flash completes.
Yeah, because Wonder Woman turns up early doors, doesn't she? Ben Affleck's Batman is floating around in his nice car. And as you say, we've got Zod returning and all of these other iterations of this world. And it's sort of weird timing, this film coming out, because obviously it comes out after all of the announcements about things being finished and no longer going on in that vein, and a whole new world being planned by Gunn. So it's an odd sort of timing for it. Does it feel like the end of an era? Does it feel like they're closing the loop on this for you?
Kind of, but not necessarily as definitively as I thought it might do. But, you know, it could be seen as a sort of swan song for that era. And, you know, you could welcome in this new sort of wave of films afterwards. But again, with that, I don't want to go into too many spoilers now, but it's not like it's a complete reset, or that it completely wraps everything up, you know, like Ezra Miller to continue if they decided they wanted to go in that direction. But yeah, if it is the last one, it feels like it's sort of quite a nice capping off of, you know, the whole Snyder series and just the sort of franchise to date, really.
You're obviously a huge fan of Keaton's Batman.
Yes.
Did this give you chills to see him back in the suit?
Yes, it did. And it was like, that was sort of the real highlight for me. And obviously, it's one of those things that it's kind of fan service. It's pushing the buttons, you know, pushing the nostalgia buttons. You know what it's doing sort of shamelessly, but it did work on me. I was just very excited to see Michael Keaton back. Obviously grew up on,
you get the Batcave back, yeah. You get, like, you know, the Bat ship, the Bat car, the whole shebang, don't you?
Exactly. And so growing up on that version of the character with Batman 1989 and Batman Returns, yeah, just seeing him back in that sort of a slightly revamped version, but his kind of classic cowl, and yeah, back in the Batcave, the vehicles, everything, like, you know, even I won't sort of say too much again, because if the trailers do give quite a lot away for this, mm-hmm. which you may have already seen, but I won't give it too much away just in case. But even just bringing back classic lines that you just like,
yeah,
oh yeah, that's good, you know, it's like they know what they're doing. And so it's not like they've crafted a film for the ages in that sense, and it's not like for me it will necessarily sit alongside those original films once the dust has settled, but it was great fun to have him back. What did you think?
I haven't loved DCEU's output. I found it very dour, up its own ass, if you will. Very sort of too serious, and like, I haven't loved it in comparison to Marvel. I've enjoyed Marvel more so far. I found this one incredibly good fun. And I've just a rollicking good romp. I was going along with it. You get two Barrys in this, Barry from the past and Barry that's traveled to the past, and then they're sort of working through a timeline together. So you get double Ezra Miller, which, if you find Ezra Miller annoying, could be too much, I think. But I find them very entertaining.
Mm. I've obviously enjoyed Ezra Miller as the Flash in the previous films. I think they're a good actor, like, get that role well, funny. I know, obviously, they've got this complicated behavior and past recently that will be off-putting to some people, but if you're just looking purely at the film, you know, and what's on the screen, I've enjoyed that. But I must say, with the double, I was kind of pushed to my limits of my patience of how much Ezra Miller I wanted. Mm-hmm. And then for me, Michael Keaton then really came in just at the right time when that was just getting a bit too much for me. So it sort of just about got away with it there.
Yeah. And I also liked Supergirl, this idea that in this other alternate universe, it wasn't Superman that arrived. It was this other being from the planet. And yeah, she's really spirited. Mm. I loved her suit. I loved her hair. The fact that she's not like a Supergirl in a little skirt with blonde hair flowing behind her. She's like this tough woman. And I really enjoyed, you know, there's no spoilers, but there is a element of looking at the past and the legacy of this world and the characters that we've loved in the past that I sort of quite liked, even though the CG of it was really quite icky. And I know you had problems with that, didn't you, Matt? That you felt like this wasn't up to scratch in comparison to like other films in this sort of genre.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, being a bit of a CG snob, but that was one of my, one of the things that I did struggle with this film is there's a lot of, like, I know you get this in superhero movies, but there's a real lot of digital doubles when, I mean, to be fair, Keaton gets a lot of it, I suppose, because, you know, at his age, he can't really be swinging around like he used to. But there's a lot of, like, characters clearly about to just enter an action scene and they just become this stretchy, wibbly,
malleable kind of weirdy thing. Yeah, like,
clearly CG putty type person. And so it depends on the limits of your tolerance for that. And then there are also some environments that say they go into where, I mean, just immense green screen and pixels. And there was, for me, again, without going to spoilers, this was just an early sort of scene, but there was a scene involving babies, which were obviously sort of animated. And I found it quite sort of disturbing, and because it just looked so poor, basically. And I think anything real and living is always hard to capture in CG. And it almost felt like they didn't even try here, or they were going for like a comedy version or something. But that was disturbing to me, and just kind of took me out of the moment a bit. It was a bit disappointing, really. That was a downside, the CG for me.
CG aside, if you are sort of saying whether people should spend their bucks on their cinema ticket, is this worth your money?
I would say so, yes. This was one of those films that they had a lot of kind of screenings of unfinished prints of this early at various sort of events and things, but that people kind of released reactions to on social media. And a lot of the early ones called it, like, you know, the greatest superhero film of all time, things like that, you know. So I certainly would not go that far. But I did find it enjoyable. It's, you know, enjoyable at the moment. There's lots of, like you said, there's lots of fun to be had. There's lots and lots of kind of nods and things. So if you think you'll get a kick out of that kind of geeky stuff, you know, there's plenty to enjoy there. I would say as well, perhaps I probably didn't do the best job of explaining it, to be honest. But despite the fact it is this kind of time travel, multiverse or parallel dimension, different version of characters world, it's a surprisingly kind of clean and neat sort of story. I thought, like, as far as these multiverse things go, it was surprisingly sort of simple in a good way and easy to follow. And I actually thought the core story of Barry trying to save his mum actually just worked and was quite nice. And there's some sort of, you know, nice emotional touches there that worked for me, and that kind of, you know, grounded it a bit with all this kind of crazy excess, you know, in terms of the characters and the worlds. So yeah, on that level, actually, yeah, I thought it was surprisingly sort of, you know, surprisingly worked there, and surprisingly simple and clean and easy to watch. And as I mentioned, I reckon anyone who's not that familiar with, you know, especially the recent films, would get on just fine with this. I think it works well enough in its own terms, despite being sort of so connected to the legacy.
Yeah, agreed. I would say if you want a superhero movie this weekend, it's hot, you want to get some of that air conditioning that they've got at the cinema, this would be a perfectly decent night out. I don't know that it will live long in the memory after you've seen it, but it certainly scratches an itch for those that are waiting for the next iteration of the DCU. I would recommend it. So if you fancy a bit of The Flash, it is out in cinemas now. Right, moving on then. It's time to get out of here. It's this.
Tyler, you were clinically dead 9 months ago. But you survived. You fought your way back. You just have to find out why.
We got a contract.
So this is Extraction 2. This is Chris Hemsworth's franchise actioner. Number two, like the last one, we found him lying in the bottom of a river at the end. What's going on? Where is he now?
Yes, so it obviously kind of looked like Tyler Rake, Chris Hemsworth's character in these films.
Which is a ridiculous name, isn't it?
It's a ridiculous name and very, very much fitting for the film. And he's obviously survived this fall. I mean, just about. He's spotted by a child in a river. He's taken to hospital. He's sort of slowly healed there, slowly rehabilitated, given a great haircut and beard trim. And then it's time for him to sort of recuperate. And it's not long before someone comes knocking, obviously, with another mission, because when you're this kind of, you know, expert mercenary, former special ops type person, it's, you know, it's never that long, is it, before someone drags you back in. And it was actually like, I found it quite an enjoyable cameo who comes to bring him back.
Yes, don't say who it is.
Yeah, it has been revealed publicly, but I will keep it a surprise because I enjoyed that. And basically, he's called back in another mission where there's a family connection. He's tasked with breaking this family out of a prison. And in doing so, it brings him into the orbit of this sort of Georgian crime family. These two brothers in particular, it's sort of, you know, that's where the story kicks off. And in comparison to Extraction, which I wasn't the biggest fan of the last film, to be honest, it had that great sort of, you know, one take action scene, but I didn't love the film. But this, I feel like, was an improvement. It strips it back, so the story felt more sort of simplified to me here. It's basically just an excuse for an old fashioned action film, and it does what it needs to do well. I thought it obviously has to live up to that kind of, you know, standout action sequence from the first film, which was this sort of really long extended, you know, that where it's a kind of trick really, but made to look like it's all done in one take. And it just takes that idea and just absolutely runs with it, with just this absolutely insane wonner, as they call it. It goes on for so long. It covers so many different environments. There's so many different elements of the action in that. It's worth watching for that alone. It's worth throwing on.
I mean,
that
it's truly impressive, isn't it? I mean, this it's got an amazing sort of camera trickery. It swoops in and out of alongside cars and across cars and top of trains, and it involves trains and helicopters and bikes and cars and prison guards and corridors and a furnace, and of course a pronged instrument is used at one point, because that comes into a different part that Rake is actually involved with. But somebody is killed with a pronged instrument in a sort of callback to the Rake offing in the first one. And it's ridiculous. How could this person possibly survive this? But he's incredibly athletic and incredibly sort of dexterous. It is fun watching Hemsworth battle his way through these various things, like a computer game come to life.
That was literally exactly what I was going to say. And especially in comparison to something like The Flash, you might say, it's often used as a negative where you say, oh, this felt like a video game. But this felt to me like a video game in a positive way. Yeah. Where you just really felt like immersed and like you were just following this character. Like, so he goes through all these different environments and these different kind of styles of action just within this one extended scene. And I didn't kind of keep an eye on the clock while I was watching it, because I sort of don't really like doing that on first viewings. But I couldn't even really estimate how long it went on for. But it was, I don't know, it must have been at least 20 minutes or...
Yeah, relentless. So, yeah, absolutely relentless.
Just non-stop. Just some really great moments in there. And then in a way, you kind of, once that bit's done, you do slightly wonder how the rest of the film will live up to that. And when it tries to do anything borderline sort of dramatic, which there isn't really that much of, it's sort of fine but never really takes off. But then you do get another very violent sort of, you know, climactic action scene, which again was fun. And for me, as someone who sort of, as well as growing up on like Michael Keaton's Batman, I also very much grew up on like the Arnie and Stallone sort of one man army action films, and it kind of, you know, felt very much like a throwback to those. So if you just want like a really over the top action film, it really does deliver.
Yeah, I mean, they try to give Rake some sort of backstory about his family. Like, I don't care, Chris Hemsworth. I don't care about your story about hospitals or whatever else it is you're banging on about. When are we going to get to another situation of you trying to kill off a helicopter with just a shotgun? That's what I want to see. And from that point of view, you get plenty of that bang for your buck. But it is 2 hours long. And it does feel like, for a film that is, you know, it's trying to be this sort of streamlined, athletic, action, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am type thing, that they've made it go a little too long, and it feels a little bit like it overstays its welcome compared to the first one, which I felt was a lot more slimline and sort of done and dusted within the time. But I do think Hemsworth is incredibly charismatic in this role. I love that he's doing his natural accent, and he's just this grumpy sod that is just really good with his hands. Yeah, I enjoyed it. And, you know, you mentioned that cameo. It is a sort of Thor throwback, which I enjoyed. I have to say, I think as a Netflix film goes, and, you know, the sort of mindless action that they do provide, this is a really good version of it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's definitely in the upper ranks of the Netflix action films for me.
The body count's appalling, obviously, like it is in Six Underground or any of the other ones. Just awful fatalities and mortalities. But they're just all bad guys, so it's fine. It's quite gruesome as well, so it's not necessarily something that little kids could watch. It's really quite violent and bloody. And then there's a very annoying child in it who I frankly was just like, leave him behind. Just let him. Why are you even bothering? He's just annoying. So I did have that element to it. But yeah, as a Netflix Friday night entertainment, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, so if you fancy getting a bit of extraction in your life, it can go straight through your telly from Friday. Right, time to move on to something a little different. It's time to never forget. It's this.
Win tickets to see your favourite boy band reunite in Athens. Are you ready?
I am ready. Today
this could be... Are you screaming yet, Rachel O'Flynn? Greatest day. Big fan, are you, Rachel?
I'm their biggest fan of the whole entire world.
Do you know who you're going to take with you to see the boys?
It's 25 years.
Double trouble?
Where is Rachel?
Here I am.
You ladies
are up front.
So this is Greatest Days, and the premise of it sounds horrible, but perhaps it isn't, Matt. It's a take that jukebox musical with their songs crowbarred into a story. How?
That is correct, and it is based on an actual stage musical, which I have not seen and hadn't seen before I saw the film. And I went into this film with very, very little knowledge, you know, and didn't really know what to expect. Obviously, someone who would, you know, could have named you some Take That songs, but it's not like I'm a massive fan. And on paper, this wouldn't necessarily have been for me, I would sort of, you know, hazarded to say. But I actually really enjoyed it.
Oh, you were going in a different direction there.
It really took me by surprise. So, you know, just to set up the sort of plot for you as it is. So Aisling Bea is sort of, you know, our lead character in the present day, and she's a nurse, and she's basically enters this radio competition to win tickets to see a performance of a band called The Boys. This film's kind of Take That stand in. And it sort of stirs up these feelings in her of her former like childhood best friends that they loved going to see this band. You know, they were classic like teeny boppers obsessed with this band. We sort of learn that they haven't seen each other for, you know, many, many years. And the film kind of is cutting between the present day and then the past, when these characters are all sort of younger and at school and sort of in the heyday of being obsessed with this band. Basically how it unfolds is, you know, we sort of follow them as these friends reunite to go on this trip. And as it goes on, we're obviously learning more about the past, piecing together what happened with their friendship when they were younger. And of course, it being a musical, it's interspersed with songs from Take That, basically. So, but obviously all performed by the cast. It's very much about these friends, these women. It's not like The Boys, you know, the band. They have this, the very, very sort of background role. So it's nothing really.
They're the MacGuffin, if you will, aren't
they? Yeah, they're the MacGuffin. They provide the music, you know, they sometimes write the music. So often it's just other characters singing. And they're the sort of impetus for getting everything going. But it's sort of not about them, because, again, that was another thing you might expect with it being a quote-unquote Take That musical. But it's not really about the band. Yeah, they just provide the music and it's this story. And so, yeah, on paper, just everything about it made me think, yeah, this probably isn't going to be for me. And there's something sort of like a bit cheap and cheesy about it. You know, it's not the most high-end musical you'll ever see. But I found something very charming about it. I actually found it quite emotional as well, I must say.
Did you have a little cry?
Well, close to that. Mm-hmm. And then it also made me think, man, Take That, I've got a hell of a lot of bangers in their back catalogue. Like, there's no denying that, you know, like they've got some absolutely great songs. And so just was enjoyable to see them and the way they were performed. And then I just thought the story of this this friendship just really worked. And I'm a big fan of Aisling Bea. I just think she's just very funny and likable. And it's absolutely great casting, I thought, of her younger equivalent, who's played by Lara McDonald. It was, you know, when you just get that in a film every now and then, when they just really nail it. And I thought that was fairly true for all the friends, actually. And another one of the grown-ups is played by Alice Lowe, who I really like. And it's just this, yeah, this kind of sweet story as well. It's all fairly low-key. And it just was one of the things I was just like, wow, that just worked in what it was trying to do. And I suppose it falls into that category that if you think, I absolutely hate the sound of that, I don't like Take That's music, and I just don't understand this film, that I'd say, yeah, probably don't go. It's not for you. But I envisage it actually being a really big crowd pleaser, especially for like British audiences, considering how big Take That are in this country, just have been.
And how much we love a Mamma Mia and things like that. We love that kind of film.
And how well that did in the UK. I could see this, yeah, being a hit, really. And I sort of hope it is, because there's something just, yeah, sort of likeable about it. And it's got this kind of, I don't know, just this sort of plucky spirit that I sort of admired, like that you can sort of sense it hasn't necessarily got the biggest budget. It's directed by Koki Gijroyk, who did How to Build a Girl, which I liked a lot as well. Yeah, and just sort of hit the spot for me that night I went to see it, really.
Am I going to like it?
I hope so. I really hope so. I know a couple of other people from TF who've seen it and enjoyed it. So that, because that's the other thing you fear with these things, is when you go to a screening on your own, you think, God, did I just lose myself in a moment of madness? Was there something in the air that night that just sort of I took leave.
Just having
senses,
an emotional episode, and maybe I enjoyed that more than I should.
Thankfully not. And it is apparently coming to Prime Video at a later date, but I actually did enjoy seeing it on the big screen. And just, I mean, musicals obviously benefit from that, and just having the music just big and loud, I appreciated. And again, in the sort of Mamma Mia aspect, I feel like it would play well with a crowd. You know, I feel like it'd be a good kind of crowd film to go and see, and you're not going to be too upset if people are, you know, being a bit noisy in the screening. I don't think it's that kind of film, you know, where again it's fun, it's plucky, it's about just the sort of the spirit, rather than, you know, you don't go to get sort of really invested in the sort of the deep drama of it. And because it's about this kind of this friendship group, it just has that nice vibe to it. It's about them sort of going to concerts and stuff. It just has a nice communal sort of vibe to it. And it vaguely reminded me of, did you ever see that film a few years ago, Our Ladies?
Yes.
And I really like that. And I would say this wasn't quite as good as that, because I love that film. But something about the sort of the younger girl's friendship sort of reminded me of that film in a way that was pleasant, just because I really enjoyed that film. So again, yeah, if you liked that, if you into a bit of sort of Mamma Mia, if you appreciate that, take that, have done several bangers, then yeah.
I'm sold. I'm going to ask my friends Kate and Caroline to come to the cinema with me. We're probably going to get a little cheeky wine and enjoy that. So if you fancy Greatest Days, it is out in cinemas on Friday and is coming to Amazon Prime later this year. Right, it's time to slip into something a little bit more comfortable. It's this.
Candice May?
Your agent told us we're about to meet Tina Turner herself.
What's going on in that head? No, you ain't acting normal.
Hey, hey, greatness, 2 o'clock.
That's not right.
That's a mad thing.
You want me to do right? You got to come on in and do.
You know how many shows you'd do in a week if you got the job? There'd be no time for distractions.
Is there something you're not telling me here?
Caleb, I didn't do nothing.
What? This is nothing, is it?
I need you to act like a responsible man.
Okay, so this is Pretty Red Dress. Matt, what is this Pretty Red Dress and who's wearing it?
This Pretty Red Dress is worn by a couple of people in this film, but to sort of give you a bit of context on the dress. So this film follows a couple, really. There's Travis, who is just out of prison, and there's Candice, who is someone who dreams of being kind of like a singer, a sort of West End performer, but she's currently just sort of working in a supermarket and sort of waiting for that big break. And they're played respectively by Natey Jones, and then Alexandra Burke of sort of X Factor fame plays Candice in what I think is her first major acting role on screen. I know she's done some stage work, but I thought she was actually surprisingly good here as well. But yeah, so these are the two main characters, really. In a weirdly sort of timely element, she is auditioning for a Tina Turner musical.
Tina.
And this film kind of played festivals previously, you know, before Tina Turner died. It played at the London Film Festival last year. So it's just that strange timing, really. But it kind of gives it a bit of poignancy, and was quite nice, I actually thought. But anyway, I digress. So Candice is auditioning for this Tina Turner musical. So Travis, he sort of splashes out and buys her this sort of sparkly, sequiny red mini dress to sort of wear to her audition, boost her confidence, etc. And basically he fancies trying it on himself. He's kind of like a seemingly a local tough guy out of prison, quite a sort of taciturn blokey bloke, I suppose you could say. And sort of, so it seems to come out of nowhere, but he kind of, you know, feels compelled to try it on. And then things develop from there, really, when he's, you know, he kind of keeps wanting to try it on. And then obviously, you know, it's going to lead to him being discovered at some point. And then also in the mix is this couple's daughter, Kenesha, who's played by Temalola Olatunbosun, who is also going through some sort of, you know, issues of her own at school. And so it's how their lives all kind of intersect and are all sort of affected by this, you know, this.
The red dress.
The red dress, yeah. It was an interesting one for me because I'd read a lot of good reviews out of the London Film Festival, and I like the performances. Like I say, I was kind of impressed by Alexandra Burke, And she's obviously a great singer, gets to sing a couple of times. And this says, you know, it's nice to hear a couple of Tina Turner numbers that are well performed. I thought Jones was pretty good as well. And I actually really, really liked Tabalola as the daughter as well. I thought probably almost the aspect of the film I was most drawn to for whatever reason. I really like that character and dynamic that she has with her parents. But then the film never really fully took off for me, in that I thought it was interesting, well played, intriguing little setup, but I felt like it never really sort of dug as deep into the idea as I thought it might, and just was almost like, it kind of, here's a concept, you know, it's explored from a few different angles, and then that was it. That's sort of how it felt a bit to me, like it never reached a sort of dramatic heights I was hoping it might do, and I never really felt like I fully got under the character's skin. And in some ways, obviously, I'm sure there's an argument to be made that that's the point. And I don't know how you took this, Jane, but it was sort of interesting to me in that he's not presented to me as like a transgender character, more of a kind of fluid person who just enjoys indulging in that side from time to time, and basically says, you know, likes to feel pretty sometimes, but he still, you know, he still is kind of happily married and didn't seem to want to transition or anything like that. Just, it was kind of having fun with it. So in a way, I thought that was interesting, but I felt like I needed to, you know, get under the character's skin a bit more.
I found it really confusing. It felt a little bit like, let's take a hot topic and bung that into this sort of kitchen sink drama. And then we haven't really done any research into it or really discovered where a person like this might take this interest, why they might do it, and how it might make them feel. Travis as a character is just operates on one note for me, and that's fury and rage. Apart from a few quiet moments when he's trying on the dress, everything else is just rage. And I found that really tiresome to watch, because I didn't feel like I was learning anything about him. He was just furious. And then I found it kind of weird and problematic that he was very concerned to a violent level that anyone would think he was gay, and that it was some sort of weird sin within the context of this story and this place we were looking at to be gay and within this sort of community than it was to try on dresses. And so I didn't enjoy the fact that it tried to say, oh, it's not that bad because he's only doing this. So there was a very strange tone about sexuality in it that I either couldn't get a handle on and couldn't understand, or that was being sort of peddled to me that I didn't appreciate. Perhaps I need to watch it again and try again with it. But I've just felt very confused and not satisfied at all with the narrative arc that it went on. It felt just as though they plucked some sort of issue out of the Daily Mail and decided to shove that in something and not actually have the balls to really go with it. You know, like when you think about something like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, that takes the idea of drag queens in a small Australian outback town. And what does that mean? And how does that reflect their inner life? And how does that reflect the bravery that they go through, and how does drag illustrate them to these people? There was none of that subtlety, none of that actual introspection, and none of that proper digging into it. And so it just felt very surface. But like you, I was very impressed with Alexandra Burke. I thought her acting was great. You know, her singing obviously was great. But it just didn't hang together for me at all. It felt a bit like that dress, the beads were hanging off it, and you couldn't really sew it back together without a professional.
Yeah, I think the main thing you said, I agree with very much the surface thing. That was one of my main thoughts. I sort of thought with the sort of sexuality aspect, it was interesting how that was explored with the daughter as well, which gave a little bit more nuance for me. I guess I appreciated the sort of conflict in this character, you know, and the sort of, given his background and everything and the world he lives in, how I suppose there was, you know, perhaps some internalized rage going on there. But yeah, I felt like it needed to dig in a bit deeper. And I was almost a bit surprised when it ended, if you know what I mean. It was one of those films that I was like, oh, well, we're at the end. I thought there was more to unpack here, you know. But, you know, an interesting conversation starter, but without perhaps providing, you know, all the sort of meat of that conversation itself, really, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I
sort
found
of encourages
it
encourages you to talk about it rather than talking about it in depth itself.
Yeah, and if it sort of helps anyone provide a blueprint for what they might be going through to parents or something. Maybe it's a great film for that. Let's go and watch this, and then we can talk about the fact that maybe I like to do this too. But it just really didn't explore it enough for me, and I found it unsatisfactory.
I was just wanted to say one more thing as well, which I realize will make me sound like a bit of a perv, but it was one of those films to me that I felt, considering the subject matter, and there's some interesting hints at the sort of relationship dynamic between this couple as well, like within their sex life. And I felt like the film almost needed sort of more sex scenes. It was a bit coy on that front and kind of cut away, basically, whenever there was, you know, we're about to get a sex scene. Whereas, you know, in this film, I think that was an important part of, you know, that the dynamic between these characters, and it kind of, you know, would have said a lot about them. So I thought it was odd that it, given it was a film that was discussing all these kind of issues, that it then was a bit coy when it came to that. I sort of, for me, that was a strange decision.
Well, yeah, you are a perv there. You just wanted more sex scenes. Matt Matum, never enough sex scenes.
No.
No, but I know what you're meaning. That I think coy is the word for this film. It's coy about everything. And really, if you're going to start talking about something like this, coy is the last thing we want to be. We want to be really digging into it and sort of really investigating it. And what does it mean to people? And what does it mean for their family? And how does that understanding come about? And it doesn't do any of that. It cuts away, literally and figuratively, and looks into a mirror and fades to black. But that could just be us. If you fancy a little bit of Pretty Red Dress, try it on this weekend. It is in cinemas from Friday. Right, that's all we've got time for this week. What's your film of the week, Matt?
Quite a tough choice really, because they're all very different. But if you could only see one, I'd say it's got to be The Flash, really, if you could only see one, just simply because it's the one you'll talk about the most, you know, if you're a sort of film geek. But then Greatest Days is also up there as well for a sort of, you know, fun night out. So, and, you know, an Extraction too. Chuck it on Netflix.
Well, that's not answering at all. Well done. I'm going to go for one, which is the film of the week for me, which is The Flash. I just thought it was far more fun than I expected it to be. A reminder that if you like this podcast, we're here every week and you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now and you're all set. Also, to remind everyone that our Oppenheimer issue is still on sale. We'll be getting a new issue incoming soon, and it's a bit of a wham bam thank you ma'am issue. Look out for that. And before we go, we do have time for a listener's question. What is the most breathtaking dress in cinema?
First one that springs to mind for me, just because we were talking about Disney animated classics earlier, would be Belle's ball gown in the sort of animated Beauty and the Beast, the yellow one. She comes down the stairs and dances around in that. Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not the biggest appreciator of couture in films, actually, to be honest. But yeah, so that's why I've just chosen an animated film from my childhood.
I'm probably going to go for also a Disney one. I did think that Kenneth Branagh's live action version of Cinderella with Lily James wearing that blue dress that was sort of iridescent and huge with this tiny nipped waist, and it sort of had an ombre effect from the skirt upwards. I actually thought genuinely wow when I saw that on screen. I couldn't believe that they'd managed to translate the wonder of that dress when I saw it in an animated film as a kid to it being stunning in reality in a live action. So two Disney ball gowns, I think we're going for. That's not very imaginative of us, is it? We should have gone for something more edgy.
I thought you were going to go for the atonement dress.
Oh, that is a cracker. That beautiful green dress. Yeah. And also the fact that it slides so nicely down a thigh when you're having a bit of naughty time in the library. That is a good one. Yes, I agree. And I mean, one thing that it won't be is the Pretty in Pink prom dress. That gorgeous 1950s dress that she chops up and puts cold shoulders in, makes into a dropped waist 80s monstrosity. Like, I don't even know what that is. Makes me just sad every time I see that one.
I mean, just thinking of modern films that had a lot of good dresses in, Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, that was a film I found surprisingly enjoyable. Love a bit of Leslie Manville.
And that had beautiful dresses in it.
That was a couture film I enjoyed, obviously. And thinking of Leslie Manville, Phantom Thread has obviously got some great clobber in it as well. And, you know, seeing behind the scenes of how it's made, that was another one that springs to mind. But to be honest, there's not an individual dress from Phantom Thread that stands out to me that I'd say, oh, yeah, that, you know, dress. So I went for Belle.
Yeah, we're boring. We've got Disney on our mind, clearly, at the moment. So with that in mind, I think we should probably say goodbye. Do it in your best Disney princess, as if you're wearing a Disney ball gown.
Goodbye.
That was terrifying. That sounded like a...
I'm trying to go Snow White.
That sounded a bit like a strange old nun. But good.
I can't do a Disney princess voice, come on.
No, okay. I probably can't either. Let's see if I can do it. Oh my goodness, goodbye. That sounded a bit Marilyn. That was wrong.
Snow White was a bit Marilyn, wasn't she?
That sounded a bit Sound of Music. I can't do it. Yeah. I'll leave it to the girls. Until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.